From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, new allegations that he told his lawyer to lie to Congress hit President Trump. The government shutdown hits local workers in Massachusetts. And Attorney General Maura Healey hits the owners of Purdue Pharma.
We will hold opioid makers accountable for the role they played in creating this crisis.
It's all part of our week in review. Also today is the New England Patriots head to Kansas City for the conference championship. The NFL faces renewed scrutiny about how it handles violence against women.
If they're going to take domestic violence seriously because they have to do that in order to make money, then it's good for victims.
And
you don't own me.
The protest music that defined the women's movement.
There's protest music all over, if you know where to look for it. And some of it's on the top 40 charts, some of it's on the pop charts.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Another week of news, another week of the government shutdown, day 28, 800,000 workers without pay, and some 8,000 local employees of the government who are struggling here in the Bay State.
What has been really stressful has been the uncertainty with when we're going to get our next paycheck, when we're going to return.
It's a stressful environment to begin with, and this has just added a whole level of anxiety and stress to everyone.
We're being instructed to do things like take up carpentry or babysit. It's a little insulting.
We have been unable to pay our rent. Our bills are piling up. We actually have a 14-day notice to quit.
And all this is having an effect on things like environmental safety and air travel.
This includes EPA inspectors who are not going out on inspections, long-term toxic waste cleanup sites that are being delayed.
It is still safe to fly, but we do have an integrated web of redundant safety layers, but we have stripped a bunch of those layers away.
So, when do we get our government back? When will the shutdown end? How will it end? Let's turn to our Week in Review panelists. With me in the studio, Tiziana Deering, professor at the Boston College School of Social Work and a member of WBUR's Executive Advisory Council. Tiziana, hello. Happy Friday.
Hello.
Good to have you. Also with us, Jim Sturgis, Executive Director of the Pioneer Institute in Boston. Jim, always great to see you.
Good to be with you.
So let's start with reaction to the shutdown now on its 28th day. Tiziana, I'll start with you. What's your reaction? We heard those voices. People are obviously feeling the effects of this. What do you think?
Many things, actually.
Yes.
But you know what struck me right off the bat in listening to those voices? There was a report that came out about 2 years ago that said that 63% of Americans don't have enough savings to handle a $500 emergency. Mm. So, you know, that's what, 500,000 government employees across the country, about 5,000 here in the Commonwealth. When you haven't been paid in a month, that is more than a $500 emergency,
yeah.
Right? So we are talking about dire financial straits at the individual level, then combined with the lack of services that people rely on to make their lives work at the government level.
It's a really good point. Let's listen to Governor Charlie Baker. He spoke to reporters earlier this week expressing frustration with the lack of progress in Washington, even as he appreciates the concern about security at the border. Here's what he said.
My pox is on all the houses down there. Border security is a really big deal. But the inability of all of the players down there to actually get their act together and come to terms on something they can all agree to is appalling.
Let me come to you, Jim, let me just get a general reaction to you about what you're thinking about in this day 28 of this government shutdown.
Look, I think it doesn't happen very often. The Boston Globe editorial board and the Wall Street Journal's editorial board say exactly the same thing, which is there's an opportunity here. And any other time we would have probably said there is an opportunity. Look, the president wants a wall, whether people like it or not, and I'm not making an argument you should want that, but the Democrats definitely want some protections for Dreamers and other people that are lacking protections, in part because of actions taken by the Trump administration. Again, in other times, we'd say this is an opportunity to make a deal, and I don't think the deal is one that would require $5.7 billion, as the president's asked. And I think they could be something that you would take a look at and try to do in a data-driven way. And what I mean by that is the following. We all know that the majority of drugs is coming through official ports of entry. Somewhere on the order of 5 to 20% of fentanyl, for example, is coming through non-official entry spots. So the question would be, what can you do about the 5 to 20%, which is important to give the president something in order to get what you really want, which would affect about 1.1 million people whose status is actually in question right now.
Hmm. Do you think, Tiziani, do you think that's the basis for some kind of deal? Because here's the thing that I'm beginning to feel about this. I mean, for the president, obviously, the wall is such a powerful symbol. It's an important symbol to his base. He doesn't want to give it up. But I'm also beginning to think that the no wall has become just as important a symbol to the Democrats. And they don't want to give that up because they don't want to give an inch to this president. So how do we get to what Jim's talking about where, you know, what government is supposed to do and negotiate and come up with a plan that makes everybody kind of sort of happy?
Well, so in listening to Jim, I was thinking, well, that would be predicated upon the people who are being intransigent actually wanting a deal. And right now, I don't think that's where we are. You know, it's been years since my graduate school training in negotiation, but there were a few principles we learned that are at play here. And one of them is when you make a voluble public commitment that you can be sort of held accountable to, that you're absolutely not going to do something, then guess what? Mm. You're stuck not doing it. So it does strike me that what's going to have to happen is the most intransigent people on both sides will have to not be part of the deal making.
Oh, that's interesting.
And there's got to be as much creativity in figuring out how to help all sides save face as there is in developing the deal itself if we're ever going to get out of this thing.
We spoke yesterday to former Congressman Mike Capuano about this issue. Here's a little bit of what he said. He told us his view on how one side or the other can come out ahead in this deal.
I've actually been waiting for one side or the other to start public negotiations. I think the first person who comes out with a reasonable proposal for a compromise, I think, might have a chance of, quote, winning.
That's interesting. I mean, he's talking about the first person to come out with a reasonable proposal for a compromise, but I just don't think anybody wants to be seen as compromising on this.
Anthony, let me build on Tiziana's point, because I think she makes a better point than Michael Capuano, which is...
Awesome!
Sorry. Which is...
We're very fond of Mike Capuano. I just want you to
know.
Okay.
I know.
Okay, no, fine.
Nice
just
guy.
To, just
all right,
to put
it.
That on the record.
No, I just want to say, I think her point, as I heard it, is... Look, you can either say no wall at all, not another dollar for the wall, or yes wall. And in that fight, you know, both of them have interest in not moving anything because they're playing to their bases. What we need is someone who is actually in Congress elected, has some position of power, Mitch McConnell or somebody, who says these are not the right conversations. The right conversations right now are about preventing more narcotics from coming into the country. That's the major issue that's afflicting lots and lots of people. Move it away from the people issue, which is really not a very significant issue, and move it to the one that actually matters to people across the country. What do we have to do to stop fentanyl from coming in? The deal there, I think, is lots more resources, lots more technology in ports of entry. And yeah, if you have to give them a little wall or this or that, in certain parts, you
some
do
metal
it plus
slats.
Technology.
Yeah.
Whatever it is, right. But you're doing it based upon what's the data-driven solution on drugs.
Right.
Move it away from people, move it to drugs.
Smart.
Yeah, there was an article in the Boston Globe, an editorial. No. Op-ed, I'll get it right the third time, today from a columnist who had a reader write in and say, you know, there are some other creative potential solutions here, like devolving this to the states, right, the border states, and giving them an opportunity, sort of doing a states' rights kind of approach that gives a lot of positionality to a lot of different players. So that kind of creativity and movement is going to be important. And again, it's going to require leadership from other or new places, I think, in order to get there.
So all this, of course, it's not happening in a political vacuum. The special counsel's investigation continues. And BuzzFeed reported today that President Trump personally directed his then attorney, Michael Cohen, to lie to Congress about the Moscow Tower project. Now, if true, this would be suborning perjury, which is a crime. BuzzFeed claims the special counsel learned about this through interviews with multiple witnesses. Tiziana, if this is true, Democrats now in Congress say they're going to, in the House, say they're going to investigate whether this is true. This could be a very, very huge deal. What are you reading in that BuzzFeed story, which has been all the talk of Washington sort of all day long today?
Well, you know, there are a couple of things. One, that it is a BuzzFeed story actually complicates things because I think it allows the White House to take a position that is not a credible source. We're not even going to respond or dignify. At the same time, the first thing that struck me is every once in a while you're in a situation where you're playing, I'm going to mix like 22 metaphors here because I'm just not that good, but you're playing chess, right? And you're moving you're planning your moves carefully, and then some kind of trigger comes in and forces your hand, forces a move. And if, in fact, it becomes really clear that the president did this, it almost forces the Democrats' hand on the question of impeachment or beginning those kinds of proceedings, because if you have clear evidence of that level of crime and there's a history of impeaching or attempting to impeach previous presidents for that, I wonder if it doesn't back the Democratic Party into a corner about what they have to do next.
Interesting.
And that's one of the first things that I thought about when I heard the news.
So, Jim, this comes on top of recently we learned that Paul Manafort discussed a peace plan. This is, of course, Donald Trump's former campaign manager. He discussed a peace plan for Ukraine with a longtime associate who had connections to the Kremlin. He also shared political polling data with him. So even at a certain point this week, Rudolph Giuliani couldn't deny that that looked like the campaign, not Donald Trump, but the campaign colluded, although he had to back off that statement. But does it seem to you that there's just more and more evidence here of what the president has long denied, that there was collusion here?
Well, I think there are two problems for the president, obviously. One is that you've got an investigation that's now has a lot of shoe leather under it.
Yep.
At this point, and there's lots of information, lots of facts that can be released in an eyedropper sort of way. That creates the drumbeat, if you will, for congressional investigations, which will start soon. And at the end of the day, this really is a political question, right? And it's not a question of a crime per se, if the Democrats want to take it that way. I'm not saying they can get through the Senate and all that, but they can create a drumbeat that lasts and continues for another year and debilitates anything that this president would like to do. My view on this is I just watch and wait until the Mueller investigation comes out, and I think that's what I'm primarily looking for. I do think BuzzFeed has a few issues with credibility, given releases of other things related to the dossier that were probably a little problematic, but this is, at this point, not a question of BuzzFeed. This is information across all media outlets.
Right. Well, I want to bring our conversation about the week a little closer to home and talk about the state of the city. This week, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh delivered his annual speech outlining his vision for Boston. He said the state of the city is stronger than ever, pointed out that lots of people are working, low unemployment. And I thought it was sort of a rousing speech. He presented Boston as sort of this city of light that stands in contrast to the divisions of Washington and everything we're talking about, actually, a place that welcomes diversity, immigrants, believes in science. Here's a bit of what the mayor said.
If you want to grow good jobs and rebuild the middle class, look to Boston. If you want to see how social justice strengthens all of us, look to Boston. If you want to cut crime, protect the environment, lift Americans up, leave no one behind, build a more perfect union, then look to the city of hopes and hearts. Look to the city of courage and champions. At a time when cities must lead, look to Boston.
So, Tiziana, pretty good moment in that speech. But what did the mayor leave out? Sure, obviously it's his job in an event like that to talk about what's great and what works in Boston. But what did he leave out?
Well, and I do want to give a nod to how much fun it is to listen to somebody who loves his job.
Absolutely. No, he made that really, really clear.
It's actually really refreshing, right? That the guy just loves his job and loves his city. What he left out is economic inequality combined with economic mobility, and the fact that that both here and across the United States is heavily correlated with race, and that we have massive challenges to solve in the city about really achieving people's ability to climb the economic ladder if they want to and they're trying, and to create a kind of mobility that constantly renews our middle class, constantly allows new people to become part of the vibrant innovation of our community, gives hope to our children, et cetera. And yes, that's a problem that faces every major American city, but both the potential for the problem and the potential for the solution are on steroids in Boston.
Yeah, interesting. Jim, what did you hear in the mayor's State of the City address, or what did you not hear that you wished you had heard?
Let me address both, actually.
Yeah.
So First thing is, I think anybody who lives here has to recognize that this is one of the greatest historical periods for Boston. I mean, it's just an incredible moment for Boston, just so many fronts, innovation, the growth of the city, the changing face of the city, changing leadership in the city. Just things are moving. They feel like they're all moving in the right place. And I think that's a lot to say about choices that were made by previous policymakers and investments that were made, and the fact that we got Harvard and MIT and, yes, Boston University and Boston College, sorry. But just a lot of brains and a lot of ability to drive innovation and kind of really newfangled cool stuff that the private market's able to do that's actually solving some problems. So that's all fantastic. What I heard as an underlying current is that he talked a lot about equity in jobs, a lot about equity in housing, but not a lot about how they were going to get there. I heard a lot about $300 million new investment in schools in a 127 school district. $300 million is not a lot of money. And then on top of that, what I didn't hear, and this is what I think people of color particularly care about, we heard a lot about how there's a new police commissioner who's of color. But we heard almost nothing. I don't remember anything. I may be wrong. There might be one line in there about the performance of the Boston public schools. And that is disheartening because that's the talent pool of the future. That's the ability to actually have the flow of people who are going to go into leadership later on. And it is troubling.
Yep. And he talked about the investment in buildings. But I think you're right. He did not talk about the performance of the schools as individual institutions of education. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good point. So time is ticking. So I want to move on to one more story this week. State Attorney General Maura Healey is taking on OxyContin maker Purdue Pharma and its owners for their alleged role in the opioid epidemic.
I promise you that we will hold opioid makers accountable for the role they played in creating this crisis. And we will do whatever it takes to hold this company accountable and to get the justice our families so deserve.
So that was Maura Healey speaking at her inauguration on Wednesday, one day after filing a complaint against Purdue, alleging that the company and its owners continued to aggressively market OxyContin to Massachusetts doctors and patients, even though they knew it was highly addictive, highly dangerous. And the complaint outlines the ties that the Sackler family and executives at Purdue had to Massachusetts institutions and names individuals at the Sackler in the Sackler family. Tiziana, this seems like a pretty bold move here and in a really important case. How does this strike you?
Yeah, I'm not a lawyer and I don't play one on TV, but it does strike me a couple of things. One, you say a bold move, but I admit that my reaction is it's a necessary move.
Yep.
That the courts are going to be part of what is necessary to obtain accountability, to obtain funding, et cetera, to counteract an opioid crisis that was at least in part seeded by the product that this company makes. I think it'll be, I listened to coverage on this show earlier this week where Nancy Gertner, the legal specialist, talks about, it's the devil's in the details.
Right.
But from an ethics standpoint, it is really hard to imagine that one doesn't look at this and conclude that this company and this family behaved unethically, created a wave of human misery and then didn't pump the brakes. And that, I think that matters. And if this is what it takes to bring that kind of accountability to light, then I think it's quite important.
Well, you mentioned former federal judge Nancy Gertner. Let's listen to her. She described this issue and said it all has to do with what Purdue knew about the drugs they were marketing and when they knew that.
Everyone is trying to pump up sales. The issue is whether or not they are doing it when they know the risks, doing it with respect to categories of people whose when they're taking the drug is particularly risky.
So, Jim, like so many cases like this, it comes down to what did they know and when did they know it?
No, I agree. And I agree with the statement that everyone's trying to pump up sales. The thing I'd say is that the rhetoric from the Sackler family might be more appropriate if you're dealing with a cholesterol-lowering drug, but you're dealing with something that's highly addictive and was known to be highly addictive pretty early. As a policy guy, what I think about is how to avoid this in the future. And I think one of the things we should not do is just by the media narrative, this is only about Purdue. Purdue is culpable and should be punished, and I think it's pretty clear that's coming. But there's a lot about careless physicians who are prescribing this stuff like candy. There's medical schools that were not really training people in addiction. There are wholesalers who are sending lots and lots of drugs to, if you take a look at the population areas they're sending them to, way well beyond what's anything even remotely reasonable, all the way down to the medical profession that was trying to push down on pain levels and saying that you had to get rid of pain for people in a way that probably would lead to overprescription of this sort of thing. So we need to think about this holistically after the fact of punishing them.
Yeah.
About how to prevent this sort of thing in the future.
Well, it's interesting. The case brings to my mind the successful case against big tobacco back in the 1990s when all those states, including Massachusetts, recouped hundreds of billions of dollars from tobacco companies. That took a long time. So I have a feeling we're going to be watching this story for many years to come. So before we run out of time, I want to end with the hubbubs, those brief stories or events that caught our attention this week. Tiziana, what was your hubbub?
So I want to put two together. There are a number of organizations in the Commonwealth that use food types of businesses to help proven risk youth who are exiting an incarceration. And we have several that are sort of known nationally for how good they are. This week, one of them, which is the Bakery Cafe end of Haley House. Mm-hmm. They employ people who are exiting incarceration. They use the funds from that Bakery Cafe.
In Dudley Square, right.
Had to close the Bakery Cafe operations as a result of gentrification in Dudley, and they don't know what their business model is going to be to reopen. At the same time, UTEC, another one in Lowell, received the first Social Justice Fund award from the New England Patriots this week. And I think that the sort of ups and downs, highs and lows and rises and falls of excellent programs that do excellent work for at-risk people but fall prey to other economic factors is just really striking. I love both those organizations. I love what they do. I'm thrilled for UTEC. I'm heartbroken for the Haley House Cafe. And we got to get behind these organizations and support what they do more and more.
Mm. Hear, hear. Jim,
your hubbub. I have a less uplifting hubbub.
Oh, man.
Sorry about that. Hubbubs are supposed to be below the fold stories.
Yes.
And mine at the start of the next semester, the second semester, is about Hampshire College, which is folding. And look, we've seen Mount Ida, we've seen Newbury College, Hampshire College. Now, the pattern is clear. These are liberal arts colleges. They're small. They do not have substantial endowments. And this is just going to accelerate. I know lots of people think there's online courses that are taking pieces of the market. I don't believe that. I actually believe it's much more STEM has risen over the past decade. The number of kids coming out with STEM degrees is by 43%, and liberal arts has actually declined over that period. This is running away from high cost, no jobs coming out of college. And this is, I think, in part a reflection of what people are thinking about the humanities these days and the way they are taught, that being a controversial statement, I know. But it's something that Massachusetts has to think about, particularly because of the rich history of small liberal arts colleges here.
Mm, I think it's a really fascinating point. Thanks for that. So my hubbub is about this rare astronomical phenomenon happening Sunday night. It's going to take place toward the end of the big conference championship game between the Patriots and the Chiefs. So if you don't feel like sitting around and watching grown men concuss each other, step outside at about 9:30, look up at the sky, and you might see that super blood wolf moon. I love that name. And we're talking about a total lunar eclipse, which occurs when the Earth lines up between the sun and the moon, coupled with the moon being ever so slightly closer to the Earth. But it might be snowing, so when you're looking up, be careful not to get hit by a rampaging snowplow. And because it's snowing, you might not be able to see the moon at all. So in that case, well, never mind.
For a second there, I thought you were referring to Tom Brady as a rare astrological phenomenon.
Well, he might well be. Tiziana Deering, professor at the Boston College School of Social Work, thanks for coming in. We really appreciate it.
It was great to be
here.
Have
a great weekend. And Jim Sturgis, executive director of the Pioneer Institute, thank you.
Have
a great weekend. Stay with us. Coming up, there's a lot more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, Maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. On Sunday, the New England Patriots will visit the Kansas City Chiefs for the AFC Championship, and a trip to the Super Bowl. To Super Bowl 53 is on the line. The Chiefs made national headlines this season because they had the NFL's top-ranked offense, and because they cut their star running back Kareem Hunt after a video surfaced of him physically assaulting a woman. The incident was another example of how the NFL struggles to deal with players who commit violence against women. As football fans gear up for this weekend's big games, WBUR's Shira Springer takes another look at this troubling issue.
This is what the NFL wants you to focus on when it's time to talk about the league and its players.
Brady on the quick slant, he's got his man for the first down. That is Edelman to the 15-yard line. Still going, touchdown.
Tyreek Hill makes the catch. We've seen it all year long, first down.
Michael Thomas doing it all, and New Orleans takes the lead.
Not this.
The Kansas City Chiefs released star running back Kareem Hunt after this video surfaced that appears to show him shoving and kicking a woman. Now it comes.
Reuben Foster was arrested 3 times in 2018, twice for domestic violence, right? He went on.
New body cam video released by Santa Clara police show a previously undisclosed domestic disturbance involving former 49er Reuben Foster and his girlfriend. As
KTVU Crime. This season, the NFL faced renewed scrutiny for how it handles violence against women. One case involved linebacker Reuben Foster. He was arrested on a domestic violence charge in late November, released by the San Francisco 49ers, then claimed by the Washington Redskins. The other case involved Kansas City's Kareem Hunt. Days after Foster's arrest, TMZ released video of Hunt shoving and kicking a woman outside his hotel residence in Cleveland. The incident happened 9 months earlier, in February. And both the Chiefs and the NFL knew about it back then.
How did TMZ get a hold of something the league and the Chiefs were not able to?
Well, Kenny, you could have asked the same question during the Ray Rice situation. How did TMZ get the Ray Rice video that the NFL couldn't after months?
The ESPN broadcasters are referring to the 2014 elevator video where former NFL running back Ray Rice was caught punching his then-fiancée.
There's no question that domestic violence is treated differently within the NFL than it was before the Ray Rice video.
That's Kim Gandy. She's president of the National Network to End Domestic Violence. The Ray Rice video and the public outcry that followed forced the NFL and its teams to re-examine how they handled domestic violence.
Reuben Foster probably wouldn't have been released by the 49ers. Kareem Hunt probably would not have been released by the Chiefs.
Kareem Hunt was cut by the Chiefs, and like Foster, he's on the commissioner's exempt list. That means he can't sign with a team until the league hands down a suspension and reinstates him. But earlier this week, the Chicago Bears intimated they'd be open to pursuing Hunt. For women working to prevent domestic violence, the headlines made by NFL players present a double-edged sword.
The more coverage we have around domestic violence, the more we're putting domestic violence in the forefront of people's minds. So that's the good part.
That's Jessica Braden. She's CEO of Respond, a Somerville-based domestic violence agency. She's also a football fan who got married in a Tom Brady jersey.
The hard part about some of this coverage is it really opens up domestic violence cases to be weighed in the court of public opinion.
And the NFL is eager to influence public opinion. In the wake of the Hunt video release, NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell praised the way the league handled the situation.
I think what we're doing as a league is extraordinary. We have, I think, some of the highest standards of any organization. We take this seriously. We have zero tolerance for violence against women. And as a league, I think we've responded very quickly.
That's not the view shared by many outside the NFL. There are plenty of cases where it appears teams care more about winning than about employing players who commit acts of domestic violence. Case in point, wide receiver Tyreek Hill still plays for the Chiefs. Hill pleaded guilty to strangling and punching his pregnant girlfriend in college. He was thrown off Oklahoma State's football team. In the 2016 draft, the Chiefs selected him in the fifth round. Gandy says that sends a message, too.
There is an impact on victims all over the country who are watching these things play out and recognizing, sympathizing with the victims in those cases, and even being re-traumatized by seeing these videos on television. It makes me feel hopeless.
For Caitlin Murphy, high-profile cases can be triggering, taking her back to the physical and emotional abuse she endured, to the time her ex strangled her and broke her leg, to the fear that no one would believe her. Murphy says when she hears about NFL players committing violence against women,
it makes me feel scared for my daughter. It makes me feel scared for my friends that I now know that are trying to get out of situations.
And while Commissioner Goodell talks about a zero-tolerance policy, that's not something Gandy wants to see.
We were very clear when we talked with the NFL early on that zero-tolerance is really not the best policy. You want to do a full investigation. You want to understand what happened. You want there to be consequences. But if the consequences are earth-shattering, then that will make victims even less likely to report. You know, if you talk to victims of domestic violence, for the most part, they don't say, I want him to lose his job. They say, I want him to stop hitting me.
Gandy, Braden, and others committed to domestic violence prevention know that public opinion will continue to influence league policy. And the NFL knows that domestic violence can affect their bottom line.
But I'll take that. If they're going to take domestic violence seriously because it means that they have to do that in order to make money, then it's good for victims and it's good for survivors.
That's a win for all the domestic violence cases we don't hear about.
And that was WBUR Sports and Society reporter Shira Springer, who's with us right now in the studio. And Shira, thanks for that piece on this important issue. And one name in your piece especially stood out to me because we're going to see him play again on Sunday, Chiefs wide receiver Tyreek Hill. He was charged with assaulting his then pregnant girlfriend. But unlike those other cases that you pointed out, there was no video of it. Do you think he'd be in the league if there had been?
Yeah, I have to say I do think he'd be in the league. I mean, you can also look to a player that was drafted in 2017, Joe Mixon. There was video of him punching a woman in a restaurant, and he was still drafted. His draft stock dropped. He wasn't drafted in the first round, but in the second. I think there are varying levels of tolerance depending on team and depending on what a team needs. It's worthwhile noting that when Joe Mixon was in the draft and he had that video out there, Patriots owner Robert Kraft said, he's not going to be on my team. I have zero tolerance for somebody who's committed an act of domestic violence.
So all about what a team, where a team wants to sort of
draw the line.
Draw that line. Yeah. So, Shira, I feel like I should ask you a quick question about the game on Sunday. It's going to feature the Chiefs' young quarterback, Patrick Mahomes, 23 years old, this year's likely MVP. He's taking on Tom Brady, who we all know is the best quarterback.
The ancient Tom Brady.
Since Julius Caesar,
yes.
I think, is when he started playing. Right. So do you see this game as a kind of, it could be, depending on the outcome, a sort of passing of the torch?
And I would say, let's not get too far ahead of ourselves. I mean, we talk about Tom Brady, as I joked, being ancient, but really, you know, Tom Brady's planning to play for a couple of more years. And, you know, Patrick Mahomes is just coming into his own, though I will say it is going to be a thrilling matchup. I mean, Patrick Mahomes, you never know what to expect from him. Those no-look passes, 50 touchdowns this year. I'm expecting a high-scoring game despite the cold weather that's forecast.
Cold weather might give the Patriots a little edge or not?
No, I think, you know, cold. Everyone is playing in the same cold weather, and both cities have experienced it.
All right. WBUR Sports and Society reporter Shira Springer, thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Listeners, stay with us. Coming up, from I Am Woman to Respect, the music that defined the women's rights movement. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. This weekend in Boston, women and their supporters will be marching in the streets 2 years after the first women's march. That took place the day after the inauguration of President Trump, when hundreds of thousands of women marched in Washington, D.C. and in cities across the country in support of women's rights. At one point during the march in Washington, musician Alicia Keys led the audience in a chant of one of her hit songs.
Feet on the ground!
At one point in Washington, Alicia Keys led the audience in a chant of one of her hit songs.
This girl is on fire. This girl is on fire.
James Sullivan writes about this song, among many others, in his new book, Which Side Are You On? 20th Century American History and 100 Protest Songs. James Sullivan is a longtime contributor to the Boston Globe and former critic for the San Francisco Chronicle. And thanks for coming in, James. Great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us about that Alicia Keys song and how it fit into the day of protest 2 years ago.
Well, you know, I think that that song is a great example, a perfect example, actually, of what I was trying to get at with the idea behind this book, which is that what we consider to be a protest song isn't always our first thought about what constitutes a protest song. I mean, I think most of us tend to think of Bob Dylan, Pete Seeger, Joan Baez, you know, a solo performer with an acoustic guitar. But the fact is, at least in my mind, that protest songs can kind of come from anywhere, and they can be any style of music. And so that Alicia Keys song and her rendition of it, leading the crowd singing it at the Women's March, is a great example. It's a pop song. When we first heard it, we thought of it as a pop song, you know, a song about individuality. But in the context of the Women's March, you know, I think it became a protest song. And I think that Alicia Keys would probably agree with us.
It's interesting that you mentioned sort of your definition of a protest song, because, I mean, I think you're right. I think traditionally we think of We Shall Overcome. But right. With the women's movement in the 21st century, there isn't that same sort of singing in the streets kind of thing, right? I mean, these songs sort of seem to jump out of the fabric almost organically.
Right. So the idea for the book actually came maybe about 10 years ago during the Occupy movement. Uh-huh. And my thought then was that there were a number of stories at the time. Hey, there's this big social movement going on, but where are all the protest songs? Mm. And if you were watching the Occupy movement, there were actually musicians there almost every day in the park in New York, you know, well-known musicians, less well-known musicians singing well-known songs, singing less well-known songs. And then there were a number of songs that established musicians wrote in specifically inspired by the Occupy movement. So I started thinking, you know, there's protest music all over if you know where to look for it. And some of it's on the top 40 charts. Some of it's on the pop charts.
Well, since we're marking the 2-year anniversary of the Women's March, I want to focus specifically on what you've written about the history of women's protest songs. So I want to go back to 1964 with You Don't Own Me by Leslie Gore and talk about this song for a bit. Let's listen to this first. I love that. Such a great sound. But I found your story about this song so interesting. So Leslie Gore performs it live at the Tammy Awards in 1964. So tell us what remind us what the Tammy Awards were and why this was such a significant and surprising song to hear at that event.
The Tammy Show was a filmed concert event, an all-star concert event in Southern California, that was intended to be filmed using some sort of cutting-edge technology at the time, and that was then going to be shown in movie theaters around the country. And the idea was that all the big stars of the day were going to come out and sing, and it was going to be sort of like a pre-Woodstock, except in the movie theaters. Hmm. So James Brown, the Rolling Stones were both famously there, and Leslie Gore, who was at that moment just about the biggest pop star in the country. And so her performance of You Don't Own Me on that show, it came out at the time that Bob Dylan was becoming, you know, tip of the tongue for music listeners around the country in 1964. I don't think anyone would have at the time looked at Leslie Gore and said she's a protest singer. However, over the next several years, as the women's movement became what it did in the 60s and early 70s, that song was adopted because it was specifically about the fact that women can make choices for themselves. They don't need to rely on their boyfriend or their man or their husband to make them for them.
Right. And it really represented a sort of departure in the pop song world, didn't it? Where mm-hmm. where there were usually women were sort of portrayed as being indulgent and sort of putting up with male antics, essentially.
Sure. And that was right at the height of what was called the girl group era, which was, you know, female voices, you know, sort of dominating the pop charts and pop radio. And most of those songs were about sort of being subservient to your boyfriend. And this song was absolutely a reaction to that or a response to that. Written by two men, exactly. They were from Philadelphia. They originally wrote it for an African American young woman, but when they heard Dionne Warwick's version of her song "Don't Make Me Over," that song came directly from Dionne Warwick saying to her songwriters, "Hey, you know, don't try to make me what I'm not. You know, let me be who I am. Don't make me over.
Don't make me over." Now that I do anything for you, don't make me over. Now that you know how I adore you, don't pick on the things.
So the two guys from Philadelphia heard that song and they were inspired to write "You Don't Own Me," which was sort of another message song, and that's where that came from.
Really interesting. I want to go back in time and talk about a genre that I love, and that's the blues. So this is Bessie Smith's version of "Tain't Nobody's Business If I Do," a song that was first recorded by Alberta Hunter. But both women recorded the song in the same year, 1923. So let's listen a little bit. So I loved it, reading about this, and it was a bit of a revelation to me, and I'm sort of ashamed to admit this. I never associated this song with women's protests, because I've always associated with a lot of male singers over the years, including B.B. King, Willie Nelson,
sure,
among others. So tell me about this version by Bessie Smith and how it fits into the history of protests.
Well, like a lot of songs, it's sort of an all-purpose protest song. I mean, sure, if a guy sings it, he's saying, you know, I'll do things the way I want to do it, but it was originally performed, as you mentioned, by female singers. And the tradition of female blues singers, or shouters, or belters, as they were known in the, you know, these strong voiced women in the 20s, was such that they, you know, they were singing songs like this one that were very much independent minded and saying, and that's what this song specifically represents. It's that, you know, hey, I'll live my life the way I want to, and you're not going to tell me otherwise.
Right. But fair to say that the blues of this period, not widely recognized as sort of feminist music or offering feminist music?
Sure. Although the activist Angela Davis wrote a whole book about some of these women, you know, Bessie Smith, Ma Rainey, Ida Cox, basically making this point that they were feminists way ahead of their time.
Speaking of Ida Cox, let's listen to another song from this time period, "Wild Women Don't Have the Blues," by the uncrowned queen of the blues, Ida Cox.
I hear these women raving about their monkey men, about their trifling husbands and their no good friends. These poor women sit around all day and moan, wondering why their wondering paupers don't come home. But wild women don't worry, wild women don't have no blues.
Wild women don't have no blues. So tell me about this. Among other things, she's indicting women who sit at home and moan about their no-good husband. So,
right.
So this is a call for women to really get up and take control, right?
Right. And in fact, Ida Cox was one of the very first women in the entertainment world to sort of run her own business. She ran a touring company. She was the star, and she was also the owner and operator. You know, this is an example. I think that one of my thoughts in writing this book was that whole genres of music, from the blues to rock and roll to punk and hip hop, have been established on a certain level as a form of protest, you know, as a reaction to something that the makers of that music felt was being disrespected on their part.
Right. So I want to bring up a song that exemplifies another characteristic, I guess you could say, of the women's movement, and that's division, not all women were behind it, and it's very apparent in some of the music coming from women during this time period. So let's listen to this well-known song, which sort of doesn't need an introduction.
After all, he's just a man. Stand by your man. Give him two arms to cling to and something warm to come to when nights are cold and lonely.
And of course, Tammy Wynette singing Stand By Your Man. What was the reception to this song by the general public and by second wave feminists, I guess?
Yeah, I think that the general public just sort of thought it took it at face value, you know, felt that, you know, she was saying, you know, do right by your man. But, you know, she spoke on the record many times that that's not necessarily what she intended. You know, she wasn't saying, I'm not a strong woman. I'll do whatever my husband tells me. She was saying, if he's down, help him out. That was it. So, you know, this is one of many songs that can be interpreted however the listener wants to hear them.
Interesting. So, James, you compiled a final list of songs emblematic of women's protest music, and I was struck that you didn't include Helen Reddy's I Am Woman, although you did write about it. This was released in 1971. It became hugely popular by the end of 1972. Let's listen to a bit of it.
I am strong.
So tell us about this song.
Helen Reddy actually spoke several times about sort of surprising herself that she, when she wrote this song, you know, she felt at the time that she did not feel like she would necessarily have called herself a feminist, but also looked around and felt like, you know, okay, the time has come for a song like this, and she was inspired to do it. And obviously she showed up at the Women's March in L.A. 2 years ago to sing that song and got a huge reception from the biggest crowd at any of the women's marches that happened around the country.
Hmm. Let's move on. I want to talk about another song. I had never heard this song, or if I did, I'd forgotten about it. It's called The Pill by Loretta Lynn, and it's a literal reference to the birth control pill. Let's hear a little bit.
This old maternity dress I've got is going in the garbage. The clothes I'm wearing from now on won't take up so much yardage. Mini skirts, hot pants, and a few little frills. Yeah, I'm making it for all those years since I've got the pill.
I love this song. You say this is the song that when the debate over women's reproductive rights spilled uncomfortably over into the country music world.
Yeah, well,
what kind of reaction was there?
Country music was, you know, at the time in the 60s and early 70s, certainly sort of a reactionary world. And there were a number of songs actually by strong women like Tammy Wynette and Loretta Lynn that were intended to say, hey, you know, this isn't just a man's world. But the reaction was strong enough that Loretta Lynn cut the song, I think, in 1972, and her record company didn't actually release it until 75. They told her, you know, nobody's ready for this yet. Huh. And they finally released it in 75. And it's a great song. And she knew it at the time. And, she, you know, it was frustrating for her that the record company wasn't on board with releasing it.
And when it finally came out in 75, what kind of reaction did it get?
Pretty much what the record company thought it was going to get. You know, there were a lot of, you know, radio programmers and the like, you know, not wanting to play it or, you know, banning it from their stations or whatever because they felt like it was incendiary or it was, you know, sort of subverting the norms in the country world, which is what it was doing.
Okay, one final song I want to talk about. It needs no introduction, so let's just dive right into it.
R-E-S-P-E-C-T, find out what it means to me.
So, of course, the legendary Aretha Franklin and Respect. Why do you think this song took off at the time?
Well, first of all, because it's a killer song, but also it's a killer song. But if you're talking about interpretations of the songs, there were those who felt like it was a song about the civil rights movement, and there were those who thought it was a song about feminism and the women's movement. So, you know, Aretha's sister Carolyn once said, you know, it's both of those things because there are all kinds of people who need more respect. And the great story about that song, I think, is that Otis Redding wrote it, but when he heard Aretha sing it, he said, play it again, play it again. I want to hear it again. And he kept saying, you know what? She stole my song, and I can't be more proud of, you know, of that fact. Like, she made it something completely different, and he was thrilled.
It's so interesting that you remind us that Otis Redding wrote it. And, of course, this is one of those facts that I heard a long time ago for the first time, and yet every time I hear it, I'm surprised about it anew because I think of it as Aretha Franklin's
just
song.
Just as Otis felt. You know, yeah. She made it her own. She took that song away from me, and that's fine because she deserves it.
Right. Right. Interesting. Well, so of all these songs we've talked about, and maybe there's one that we haven't talked about, what's the song that's had the biggest impact or staying power in the women's movement and feminism?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, you mentioned that I Am Woman. I mean, that's an anthem. I mean, you know, I don't know if that's the biggest one, but, you know, I'd probably go with either that or Respect. They're both songs that have certainly withstood the test of time and still are looked at as feminist anthems.
All right. Well, James Sullivan, longtime contributor to the Boston Globe and former critic of the San Francisco Chronicle, his new book is called Which Side Are You On? 20th Century American History in 100 Protest Songs. And we've been talking about women's protest songs on the 2-year anniversary of the Women's March. James, thanks so much for coming in, and thanks for this great book.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
All right, and we'll end today with Respect because that's always important, and because, like the man said, it's a killer song. I'm Anthony Brooks. Have a great weekend. Join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.